hope everybody had a good dinner. Everybody eat well?
Yes.
Okay. Now that everybody's full, I'd like to make some announcements which are already in your program, so you probably already know them. Following Tom Brady's talk tonight, there will be support groups held on the 6th floor and also on the 7th floor. Pleased to be able to introduce the next speaker, who I first heard of 10 years ago, which was recorded and which I listened to for an entire summer. And I have probably gone through two or three tapes of that talk, and it's been real important to me. Thomas used to be a college professor, ended up in administration, and from there he has become a consultant for chemical dependency treatment centers in the southeastern part of the United States. He has written a book, and he does a number of these kinds of talks to professional communities and recovering folks. And I'm real pleased and happy to present Tom Brady, Jr.
You can
plug yourself in.
Where you want to put it, right here. Back a little heavier. Hope everybody had a good dinner. I want to say something to begin with that will make me feel more comfortable. It always does. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink since July 20th of 1965, for which I'm indeed grateful. I found out this afternoon on Piedmont Airlines what a sardine would feel like if he were alive. And during the ride, I figured out that sardines are better off than we are when we ride airlines. At least they're dead when they're packed, you know. And it's always my fortune to sit down beside someone about my size or larger, and he was there. And I'm 6'3", and the man in front, who was even larger, decided to recline his seat. Now, when you're trapped at 33,000 feet and have to go to the bathroom and find out it's full, you're in a hell of a mess. And that's about where I was this afternoon. I want to tell you at the outset that the time allotted for this presentation tonight far exceeds my knowledge of the subject, so we won't we won't be here as long as the program says. And that's not humility, that's the truth. I was thinking today, and over the last few days, those of you who've heard me talk before know I'm kind of a nut on music. I'm a great fan of music that has good melody, good words. A special fan of James Taylor, who's a North Carolina boy, and Kris Kristofferson, and some of the other writers. And I couldn't help thinking about the recovery process that I'm going to share with you tonight, and that's what I'm here for, to share, not to speak. Reminds me of a song that was done many years ago, and many of you are not old enough to remember it, and some of you are but won't admit it. And it was done by a singer named Nat King Cole. Any of y'all remember Nat King Cole? God, what a singer, you know. And this was a song that really brought him national prominence, I think, for the first time. And I think it's very apropos, and I'd like to share that with you as kind of a theme for the night for what I'm going to say. And the song was called Nature Boy. Do you remember it? Now, there was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little child and sad of eye, but very wise was he. And then one day, one magic day, he passed my way. And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me: the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. That, to me, is the goal of recovery. To learn just to love and be loved in return. And for us recovering people, the first part is much easier than the last. And I'll get into that with you a little later. In spite of all the education that has gone on through the years, I still run into families who believe in this pervasive myth which still persists about recovery. And it goes like this: when the drinking and drugging stops, all will be well. It's incredible how it's held on for these years and probably will hold on for a number of more years. That the recovered person will be okay. Act like an adult. Be responsible. And that the family will somehow come together, as if by magic. That whole myth, I think, is based on a belief in some kind of magic. And the same people who believe this myth seem to believe also that God's the tooth fairy. It strikes me that way sometimes. The truth of the matter is, and you know it as well as I, but I'm going to cover the ground again, that stopping drinking or drugging is only the beginning. I'd like to share with you a quote from a book that was written over 40 years ago. It was began to put together by a program that started over 50 years ago. And the book is called Alcoholics Anonymous. And on page 82, you read the following. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a person is unthinking when he says that stopping drinking is enough. And it goes on to give a story about a man who comes out of his cyclone cellar, and his whole farm has been leveled. His home's gone, everything's gone. And he turns to his wife and says, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it nice the wind stopped blowing?" The damage that we do, and I can speak as one, is never, ever made over or made better simply by stopping drinking or drugging. In addition to that, the recovered person is not an easy person to live with. He's a lot like a sick person without his medicine when he stops drinking. In that same blue book, a little psychiatrist wrote, "When the alcoholic is not drinking, for instance, he is restless and irritable and discontented." That's an understatement to me. If I can be a little more blunt about it, it was like I'm going to fly into a million pieces any minute and nothing can stop it, and I don't know why. And if I could be indelicate with you for a minute, it reminds me of a story. Any of you ever hear the story of the golden screw? Anybody? Seems this guy, one guy over there, are you the one that had the golden screw? Seems this guy was born with a golden screw in his navel. And he couldn't go swimming with the other kids without a belt, you know, and a buckle over it and everything. And he worried about it, and he was a religious person, and he pounded the gates of heaven and worried God to death about this golden screw. And when he got ready to get married, he said, "I've got to have this screw removed." And he demanded it every day. And finally, a big voice with a Yiddish accent came down and says, okay, enough about the screw. He said, "I want you to lie down on the bed and get very quiet. Close your eyes. Count to 10. And when you've counted to 10, open your eyes and you'll see a cloud coming across the bed. And on the cloud will be a golden screwdriver. And I want you to take the golden screwdriver and remove the golden screw and put the screw and the screwdriver on the cloud. It's going to go away, and I don't want to ever hear anything else about the golden screw." And the guy was very pleased, and he laid down on the bed, you know, and he got quiet, and he counted to 10, opened his eyes. Sure enough, here comes the cloud. He was delighted. The golden screwdriver on the cloud. He reaches over, takes the screwdriver, undoes the golden screw from his navel, puts the screwdriver and the screw on the cloud as instructed, and the cloud goes away. The guy is in ecstasy. It's fantastic. And then he stood up, and his ass fell off. So I think restless, irritable, and discontented is an understatement about this whole thing. The alcoholic and the addict who are without drugs and alcohol are, if you will, through recovery, trying to find a way to attach the part once more without using drugs or alcohol. I also heard a lady say one time, and it tickled me really good. She was talking about her husband, and she said, I always thought I wanted him to get sober. And then one day, there he was, stark, raving, sober. And I didn't know what to do with him. And she went on to say, I realized after a time in my own recovery program that I had preferred him to be drunk. He was predictable, he was manageable, and I liked it. The truth is, too, that many families remain sick or break up after recovery. Why? Why is all this? Why do people continue to believe in the myth? I think part of it has to do with not understanding the nature of the illness, not understanding the nature of the recovery. And the belief in magic that I mentioned to you. Many families, too, continue to let the recovered person be the hub around which the family spins. I remember back when I was still drinking. And if I was drinking or drunk, my wife and daughter might as well have been in the same shape. Their whole attitude, their actions, their reactions were dominated by me. To let that happen after recovery is to cheat yourself. Some families resent the people in the groups that are helping the recovered person to get well. And they resent the work involved. Going to meetings. Some of them really don't want the chemically dependent person to recover. If that sounds incredible, I'm sorry. Some don't. What I'm going to try to share with you is a view of what recovery really is and what is involved so that families will understand. And to give an overview of some periods of recovery during the first 7 years, if I can get that far. And what I'm going to focus on is the problem areas which probably will arise during those first 7 years, so that families may better know what to expect and maybe be able to handle the situation better. There's a very good chapter in that same blue book that tells you about some of these things also, chapter 9, called The Family Afterward. I recommend it to you for your reading, seriously. Now, I don't want to leave the impression tonight that recovery is a downer. It's not. It's an upper for the most part. It's a grand and a glorious and a wonderful thing. But there are problems. And these are pretty deep and pretty serious problems. What I'm going to do is give you an inside-out view, the perspective of a recovering person, and hope it will be usable to you. What I'm going to share with you tonight is not encyclopedic. It does not apply to all recovering people. The time frames that I use will not apply exactly. And it's based on personal observation and experience over this more than 20 years of myself and of others. It is not scientific. It is my hope that some scientists will get interested in this and make it that way. So what I say is my opinion. I'm going to use the third person masculine, ladies, and I mean nothing by that. I tried to give a talk one day using the third person feminine, and I failed miserably. I couldn't do it. I guess it's the chauvinism left in me or something. Draw your own conclusion. And I'm going to use the perspective of the self-help groups in regards to recovery. Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. Do you know how many self-help groups there are now? I called the central office of Alcoholics Anonymous not long ago looking for Emotions Anonymous. And she said, I don't know, Tom, but I can refer you to the National Clearinghouse for Self-Help Groups. Are you ready for that? There are hundreds of them. Hundreds of them, all using the same simple life-changing program, which I still consider to this day to be the most effective life-changing program ever to come down the pike. I don't know why. It just seems to work and work very well. The illness of chemical dependency, let's take alcoholism. to break it down simply, as I do to patients sometimes, it has two basic parts. One's alcohol and the other one's ism. Now, the alcohol problem, the drinking problem, ends when you put the top on the bottle. That's an event. But the ism is a much more serious matter. And it requires a long-term process in order to recover. And most recovery programs deal essentially with this ism. Again, it's a process, not an event. There is no magic. The recovering person will not get well overnight. I believe, too, that the process of recovery is very much a learning process. And by learning, I mean a permanent change in behavior, which is brought about by sustained practice of gained knowledge. If no change in behavior occurs, no learning has occurred, in my view. And I believe we learn to recover just like we learn arithmetic, if you will. You want to learn arithmetic, you sign up for the course, you pay your tuition, you buy your text, you go to class with other people who are trying to learn arithmetic, you listen to your teacher, you read your textbook, you do your work assignments, guess what? You learn arithmetic. Some not so well, some better, you know? But you will learn, and you stand a better chance of doing it. And I believe that recovery, sobriety, really is the same thing. You sign up for the course, pay your tuition, buy your textbook, go to class with those who are trying to recover, listen to your teachers, do your homework, and lo and behold, something begins to happen. The goal of recovery is, of course, that thing called sobriety. A lot of definitions of that word. I got to tell you what I mean by it. What I mean by sobriety is an alcohol and drug-free state of being, which is characterized by freedom and happiness, the ability to accept oneself and others, the ability to live with unsolved problems, and I could add to that list. It is very much a state of being. Recovery is the movement, in a sense, from sickness to wellness, from intoxication to sobriety. And I believe it's essentially a spiritual process. That recovery is a matter of spiritual growth, and this spiritual growth is the essence of recovery. Now, every time I mention the word spiritual to a group of people, I am sure that I am misunderstood. Now, you're going to get a good talk on spirituality, so I'm not going to give you that tonight. I've got to tell you what I want to share with you. By spiritual, and I can see in your heads church steeples and pulpits and Sunday morning, and if you're a Baptist like me, you know, Sunday night and Wednesday night and Thursday night, you know. My mom is a black belt Southern Baptist. Who, by the way, conceived me to be a Baptist minister. That's what she wanted, you know. Wonderful lady, gorgeous, 80 years old, going on 21. Beautiful woman. I love her, and I love her very much, and have a great deal of respect for her. I don't mean that. Some people think, too, and I can almost see the picture of a big word coming in their mind, God, when I mention spiritual. And this is as it should be. But I think we have to come down further than that. I think spirituality includes people. I think that spirituality, to use a phrase from Carl Jung, is a natural thirst of our being for wholeness. And wholeness only comes through relationships. Now, when I was drinking, in between every two drunks, I went back to that Baptist church. And I hit the aisle. And I waited for the tap of the magic wand from this one called God. But guess what? I wanted nothing to do with the people in that church. I had problems with people. I didn't like them. I didn't trust them. Everyone I did trust hurt me, it seemed. And so I didn't do it anymore. And I look at the great spiritual teachers of mankind, and when they talk about spirituality, guess what they talk about? They talk about relationships. Relationships, and that's what it boils down to. And most of them, be it Lao Tzu, Buddha, Jesus, Moses, you name them, across the board, say there are two basic relationships in spirituality. The one is horizontal. It has to do with me and you. And the other is vertical. That has to do with me and the higher power. And then they say something very strange. They say, unless you relate on the horizontal level, there will be no vertical. First things first. But when you do relate on the horizontal, the vertical just comes. And right in that intersection is the whole meaning of life. And I believe that. I believe it's very much a matter of relationships. I believe along that line that we, the word we, two-letter word, is the key word in recovery. And that I is the key word in illness. And recovery then, in my frame, is moving from a place of isolation to a place of relation. From I to we. This involves a profound and radical change in the inner self of the recovered person. Values, beliefs, and perception change. It's a matter of his discovering, discarding, and replacing old values and old beliefs, the stuff out of which life is made. I like what Carl Jung said. He called this change a vital spiritual experience. And said it was in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. The ideas, the attitudes, and the feelings that used to guide the lives of these people are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of motives begins to dominate them. Recovery, too, I believe, has two basic phases. Rebirth and regeneration. And I'm using spiritual terms here, folks. Rebirth begins the process of recovery. Rebirth to some people is a two-syllable, seven-letter word. To us who are recovered, it is the most real thing on the face of the earth. It is not just a word. If rebirth brings up connotations for you that you do not like, try the Greek word, metanoiao, which means I have changed my mind. I have changed my attitude. I have changed my direction. If you're more scientific, try the words paradigm shift. My favorite philosopher is a Jewish man named Martin Buber. And Buber calls rebirth a turning. A turning. A going in a new direction. And I like that. Whatever you call it, it's a brand new beginning. By a brand new person. Regeneration is the making over of this person. He or she literally becomes a brand spanking new person. I think that's wonderful. I know the lady I was married to when I got sober said to me after a number of years of sobriety one night, "You're not the same as you were when I married you. You're not the same as you were 2 years ago. You're a better man now than you've ever been. I've been married to three different men, Tom." Make my point? My point is that recovery follows a pattern like that after the first birth. It's a matter of growing up. A child is born and he grows. A recovered person is reborn, and he grows. There's a big difference, though. When we're born the first time, to use my terminology, we're born with no baggage, no values, no attitudes, no beliefs, no perceptions. When we're reborn, we have a load of baggage. In the beginning, the recovered person is quite literally, in my frame of reference, an infant. He cannot be expected to behave like an adult, and he cannot be treated like an adult. He hasn't even entered, if you will, adolescence. Any of you who are married to us might feel that I'm saying something that is true. And some of you recovered people out there are going to hear me say things tonight and find that you're in one of the stages that I'm talking about. Don't despair. Just squirm a little. If the family can understand these things, think of all the trouble it might preclude or prevent. I'm going to describe the recovered person during these periods and some of the behaviors you might expect. The first period I want to cover is the infancy period. This is from 0 to 2 years in recovery, roughly. Now, every infant needs a cradle. I've never known an infant that didn't need a cradle. And the self-help group to which this person belongs usually becomes that cradle. He feels safe and loved and understood and protected and accepted. He senses that he belongs in that cradle with others like himself. The group provides the framework for his early learning experiences. Problem is that the family may resent this. They may become jealous. After all, they've done without him for all these years, or they've had him in terrible shape, and now he's spending more time at meetings than at home. The group is replacing them, doing what with all their prayer and effort they have not been able to do. Every infant needs mothering and fathering. In self-help groups, there's an individual usually who's called a sponsor. And the sponsor is the mother-father figure, if you will. The sponsor is not a counselor. Some people are misguided on that. The sponsor is more like a guide and a teacher. He listens, yes. But a counselor, you know, when he tells you to do something, will ask you how you feel about it. Have you ever noticed that? You know, go do so-and-so. How do you feel about that? My sponsor never asked me how I felt about anything. He said, go do it. And if I said, why? He said, because. That's the only reason I ever got. Because I told you to. Your family may really resent your sponsor. Mine went to my family in the beginning and said to them quite candidly, Tom's going to be with me more than he's going to be with you for the next 6 months to a year. The reason is very simple. He needs me more than he needs you. I ain't like that. Very open. And he suggested that the family seek help of their own. Donna didn't like this man. She had a name for him. She called him the Lone Arranger. True. And he'd pull up at the house every night, you know, and blow the horn on that Continental and wave that cigar out the window, you know, and I knew it was time to go. I didn't know where we were going, but he was there. And she'd come in and say, he's here. I'd say, who? Him. Him who? The Lone Arranger. Deep resentment, which later turned to deep love between the two of them. To add to all this, the recovered person seems to care more about his peers than about his family. One of his fellow recovering persons can call him, you know, and he'll spend hours on the telephone with him, really get into his problems, even weep over the problems with him. Go out in the middle of the night to see somebody. And his wife comes up with a problem and there's no interest. His kid comes up with a problem and the wife can handle it. This kind of thing. He turns to the peers for help. Again, the family may resent this. There's a danger here. If the family pushes him at this point to change what he is doing, the possibility of relapse is very great. Things are as they should be when they're like this. Alcohol was the number one value, the dominant value in this person's life, or drugs. And now sobriety is. The shift in values is already occurring on a very low level. And his fellas and his sponsor are the representatives of this new value, this sobriety. They can teach it. Therefore, like it or not, they are probably more important to the recovering person at this point and to his family than the family itself. During the 0 to 2 period, the guy or gal really fears cradle invasion. Have you ever noticed that? especially, it seems, by his family. He fears outsiders will mess up what he's got going. He's found a gold mine, and he doesn't want any claim jumpers coming around. He will experience grief of the deepest possible kind. Grief. He will grieve over the loss of his best friend. Alcohol or drugs, whatever his drug of choice was. He will wish for it, especially the feeling produced by it. He will long for it at times, especially during periods of distress. He'll dream about it. Alcoholics and addicts in the first few months of recovery and thereafter, and possibly for the whole period of recovery, dream about the drug. I was in a meeting not long ago, and there was a young guy in there who had been sober about 90 days, and he was really distraught. And so we dealt with his problem at the meeting, and his problem was, I'm having these dreams about drinking. Every night I'm having these dreams about drinking. I'm voluntarily doing it. I'm seeking it in the dream. Some of the old heads there pointed out to him he should be grateful that his unconscious is doing for him what he better not do in consciousness. And I got to tell you something. During the process of recovery, even the nature of the dreams change. In the beginning, I had those dreams. And then there was a change. And I still have those dreams, maybe once a year, maybe twice a year. But in these dreams today, I am not seeking a drink. I am being forced to take one. And I wake up screaming. They're nightmares. I submit to you, that's a deep change. That's a deep change in a human being. But the grief process will be there. Expect it. The alcoholic is very guilty over his past, as is the drug addict. Seems that when you take away the drug, what you have left is an over-responsible, a neurotically over-responsible baby who'll take the blame for everything. At that point, we're patsies for guilt trips. Tell us it's our fault. We'll believe it. We'll believe it. We fear for the welfare of our children. This is how deep the guilt really runs. I remember during this period of my sobriety, I would wake up with a start in the middle of the night many times, run into my daughter's room, listen to see if she was breathing. Not being satisfied with that, put my hand on her chest to make sure her heart was beating. You see, I was convinced that my behavior was going to bring harm to her. Not just harm, fatal harm. This guilt also causes us to be incredibly self-conscious, bordering on paranoia. I don't use that word much anymore because a doctor friend of mine says, about paranoia, if you believe people don't like you, you're not paranoid, they don't. And I kind of have backed off on that word a little bit, but incredibly self-conscious. I had a problem with this, and I'm going to share a lot of personal information tonight. Hope you don't find it in bad taste. If you do, that's your problem. I was terribly self-conscious. You know, people used to stare at me all the time. And my habit was, especially women, you know, women would turn around and stare at me, and I would immediately check my fly. Any of you guys do that? I knew something had to be wrong or they wouldn't be staring at me, you know. And I was an inveterate fly checker just all the time. And when I was at the college, I went across one day to the local greasy spoon with a very nice English professor there who was a lady. And, of course, three or four ladies turned around and looked, and I grabbed for the fly. And Susan knocked my hand away and said, "Damn it, Tom, has it ever occurred to you the reason they turn around and look at you is because you're a very attractive man?" And I said, "No." Incredibly self-conscious, afraid that you were wrong. A persistent sense of being wrong, always wrong. Even when there was nothing wrong, it was wrong. Most of us are anxious to make everything right. Now. Right away. Because of our guilt, we let our children do as they please, even encourage them to do as they please. During this period, we're very self-centered. We crave attention. We have intense oral needs. Have you ever noticed that? Kissing, smoking, drinking coffee, you know, on the increase. I never had over 2 cups of coffee in my life till I came to the program. True. And I was a light smoker. Those are things I'm still having to deal with. Not very well, I might add. Bottom line, the recovered person hates himself and is not aware of it. Is not aware of it. Chemically dependent people are, to me, world-class self-haters. And this is not widely understood. Most of us, as you know, are perfectionists. We've got to have everything just right. We're idealists. Everything's got to be the way it ought to be. If we don't do a job perfectly, then we've failed. If everything's not the way it ought to be with us, then we've failed. Everything we do, even if it's a success, turns out somehow to be a failure. And when you fail, you dislike yourself. And if you fail many, many, many times, eventually the dislike will multiply on itself and you will hate yourself. But we're not aware of it. You know, much is said about the narcissism of recovering people or chemically dependent people. And this is true. But narcissism has two poles. One of my favorite philosophers, too, is an obscure Greek named Heraclitus. How many of you ever heard of Heraclitus? He was called the dark because he was so obscure. And Heraclitus said at one point, every phenomena consists of contrasting pairs. There is no day without night, no heat without cold. Okay? And the same is true of narcissism. On the one pole is self-love. On the other pole is self-hate. I submit to you, chemically dependent people are not necessarily in love with themselves, but they are deeply in hate with themselves. It shows up. During this period of time, he will reject compliments and approval. You did a good job, Tom. Oh, I should have done better. You're a nice man, Tom. Oh, I'm working at it. He doesn't realize that underlying that is one of the children of narcissism, one of the children of self-hate, and its name is, I am no damn good. He pushes away those who attempt to love him. And another child of self-hate underlies that. Don't love me. I don't deserve it. During this period of time, he will give and give and give and give and give. But if you notice very closely, he cannot receive. The word on me was for years, don't ask him for the shirt off his back, he'll give it to you. But do not try to give him yours. He can't accept it. We build a protective wall around ourselves. Donna used to say, Tom's a very private person. That was a nice way of saying no one gets close to him. He's unable to handle intimate relationships at all. During the 0 to 2 years period, also physical problems begin to appear. You know, he becomes aware he has a body, maybe for the first time in a long time, and it seems like within that body, nothing is working right. He's sick a lot. I used to go to my family doctor, a lovely man named Bill. And Bill, when I would tell him all of my problems, and I was a borderline hypochondriac after I got into recovery, maybe full-blown hypochondriac. I had all kinds of ills. And he would look at me and he'd say, Tom, I told you if you ever quit drinking liquor, you were going to fall apart. That's all the sympathy I ever got out of him. We sleep a lot, tire very easily, often feel down. Some people believe we have blood sugar problems when we cease drinking or drugging. This may be part of the cause. And the body is readjusting after being mistreated badly. And it could be that we're just tired. Have you ever thought about, in saying that, we're just tired, how hard it is to be a chemically dependent person? Tell me a job that is harder than being an alcoholic or a drug addict. Tell me one. We work at it night and day. And maybe we're just tired. During this time, too, probably the most dangerous thing is that the person may become spiritually intoxicated. Get to the point where walking on water is old hat to him. And he tries to push these ideas on family, and he talks down to them. I know a guy who actually told his wife, when she had a physical, bona fide physical ailment, if you'd work the Al-Anon program, this wouldn't have happened. We're strange. We may try to save the world. I talked to a guy yesterday, 9 months away from addiction. Got that? 9 months. And he was on an ego trip and didn't know it, so I was just listening. I didn't want to say anything, wouldn't do any good. And he had been appointed chair of a mental health organization. Was sponsoring 13 people. Really? Was going to build a detox and a treatment center. Man's not well. But you know, this is a natural process too. Any of you ever been in the psycho ward that will admit it? Patient, visitor, anyway, you know, you've seen people do the Thorazine Shuffle, you've been there. When I was in there one time for 3.5 months, I noticed a phenomenon going on in the nut ward that I call the nut to shrink syndrome. You ever notice that? Every nut in the place wanted to be a shrink. Every one of them. You go to some of the treatment centers for alcoholism and drug addiction, and guess what? Every patient in there wants to be a counselor. Got that? Maybe it's natural to do that. We, now in North Carolina, we call that getting good before you get well. Getting good before you get well. There's a beautiful story told about that by one of my friends. He told about this, trying to show the difference between getting well and getting good. He told a story about a railroad man who got into the program and sobered up. Sober 18 months, and the company put him back on his old run. And he rode the train down to place, and he got off and he did his work, you know, went on to the boarding house where he usually stayed. And when he opened the door to his room, there were two women waiting for him. And he looked at them and he said, "Ladies," he said, "I've joined the program and I'm trying to get well. Now one of you is going to have to leave." Now, when we become spiritually intoxicated, the sponsor and or the group usually handle this in a very direct and indelicate fashion and bring us down. There's sex problems during this period. The recovered person may be impotent or uninterested, at least at home. On the other hand, his lust for alcohol and drugs may shift to sex. It may surprise you that some of us recovered people call sex the third drug. It's used as a drug. It's justified by falling in love. I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to ever last. My heart should be well schooled because I've been fooled in the past, and yet I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. We do. In all seriousness, I have seen sick sex bring about more relapses than any other phenomenon since I have been recovering. And the old timers in the self-help group know about this. And so you go into the self-help group, and here's this old guy, and he says, "Now, no he in or she in." And you think to yourself, well, this old dude's against sex. And I'm not going to pay much attention to what he says. He'll go on and say, don't make any decisions about romance for the first 1 to 2 years. These are some of the problems that families may face during the infancy period. Not all, but an overview. The second period I want to talk about is the toddling period. 2 to 5 years. How many of you are married to recovering people? Let me see your hands, please. You can say yes to what I'm about to say. Do you realize that recovering people go through the terrible twos? Go through the process called the terrible twos. We attempt to control the family, attempt to control the group. We're aggressive, grandiose, self-righteous, arrogant. Stand around meetings and see someone ask somebody else a question and wonder why he's asking him. Why not me? I've got all the answers. You know? It's like I had a shell sign over my head, and I'm the shell answer man. And he's not conscious of it when it's happening. I'll tell you the top notch of arrogance. I was heard to remark in a meeting one night that I thought it was very nice that Jesus had his spiritual awakening at the same age I did. It's a good thing I've learned to laugh at me. Ooh. But we in effect sit in a high chair and beat it with a spoon and say, do it and do it now and do it my way. What's happening is that the old self is trying to reassert itself. How many of you have read some of the writings of Dr. Harry Thibault on the ego and ego return and the need for surrender and this type of thing? If you haven't, please do. The old self here is trying to reassert itself. See, the old self doesn't just go away. It dies very slowly. Old habits of thought will reoccur. Old behavior patterns will reappear. And we shouldn't be surprised. Every child passes through this stage during his growth process, and so does a recovering person, the terrible twos. And again, most often, the recovering person is not conscious of what he's doing. During the 2 to 5 year period, he may have wide and sudden mood swings. He's often depressed. When I was about 4 years sober, I went into a depression that lasted for 16 months. It was accompanied by a terrible ear infection that no specialist could fix. And I knew I was going nuts. And there was a difference. Drinking did not enter my mind. Suicide did, many times. And I finally went to a good doctor. And he gave me, in my case anyway, a 6-hour glucose tolerance test. And my blood sugar level was bottomed. He put me on a high protein diet. Lots of vitamins. Within 10 days, both the depression and the ear infection were gone. This may not be the case with all people. We are often depressed, probably with different reasoning. Our guilt level comes down a little bit. We no longer accept responsibility for all things that happen, and some of us refuse to play the old games anymore. And if the family member is still playing the old games, and you're not playing anymore, trouble is on the horizon. During this period, too, he's very compulsive about saying yes to all recovery-related activities. Yes, 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 yes. Probably because he feels obligated, or, honestly, because he feels no one else can do it as well as he. And he tries to play catch-up with his family, especially the children, during this period. And gets mad if the expected results don't come to pass, by the way. I set out on a tear one time to be a good father. I was very serious about what I was doing. I was going to make up for not being one in the past. And I had my two youngest kids out all the time doing something. We went to Carowinds. We went fishing. We went to the playground. We went to the park. We did everything. I was really into being a good father. And one Saturday morning, I came in bright and bushy-tailed, and I said to my two kids, "Well, what do we do today?" And my son Jason said to me, "Dad, do you mind if I stay home and play with my friends today?" It almost destroyed me until I started thinking about it. During this period of time, too, sexuality is very much on the rise. Spiritual growth, in my belief, is paralleled by growth in a person's sexuality. Don't know how many of you are familiar with Scott Peck and his work. Scotty made a talk one time, and I heard it, in which he called sexuality and spirituality kissing cousins. And he made the statement that the sources of our sexuality and spirituality are so close together that it's impossible to arouse one without arousing the other. He said that some religious judge the depth of a spiritual conversion by the change in the person's sexuality, the depth of it. He pointed out that some of the greatest erotic writing throughout history has been done by celibates, who some of us consider passionless people. If you could read some of Janie Gustafson's stuff, or read St. John of the Cross, the Dark Night of the Spirit poem, if you want some good erotic literature. And I think there's some substance to what he's saying. Problem. Spirituality and sexuality are often confused. In my belief, they're both parts of that thirst that Carl Jung talked about. The thirst for wholeness. The spirituality being a thirst for union with a higher power. The sexuality being union with another human being in intimacy. We have a profound tendency to seek God in romantic relationships. And there's the rub. We take another human being and put him or her in the very center of our lives. Make of him or her a god. And it won't work. During this period of time, too, the value system of the recovering person revolves around himself. Please remember as I go through this, while all this is going on, all these possible problems, much that is good is happening also. Don't lose sight of that. Recovery is, by and large, as I said, an upper, not a downer. Suffice it to say that the recovering person, 2 to 5 years, passes through much the same stages as a 2 to 5 year old child. And again, I believe this is as it should be. The next period is 5 to 7 years. I call it the choosing period. And it's a very critical and very crucial period in recovery. You might think that after 5 to 7 years, man, you got it made. Not true. It's the time to choose between the old self and the new, and the old way of life and the new. It can be the beginning of a new and meaningful growth, or it can be the beginning of regression or relapse. Down in North Carolina, we have a name for this period of time. We call it 5-year menopause. And it's when the alcoholic comes to one day and he looks around him and he says, "I've been working hard. I've really been doing all I know how to do to change me, and look, nothing's changed. Is this all there is?" And he begins to wonder if it's worth it. He becomes aware at this point that recovery has no termination point, that it's an ongoing process, and it's sometimes difficult, sometimes painful, as well as rewarding. And he may return to the terrible twos, or he may return to the infancy stage and make 9 and 10 and 12 meetings a week and stay in the cradle, and nothing ever changes at home. And nothing ever really changes in him. Or he may relapse. Many relapses occur during the period of 5 to 7 years. It is very crucial time. The basic choice during this period is to continue growth or to go back to the old life. And here's the point where the recovering person must start utilizing the recovery program as a way of life. No longer is he backing away from alcohol or drugs. Now, that is not the present problem. The problem is living. And these self-help programs bring us to a point where they say we practice these principles in all our affairs. And that's the point you too. I remember not long ago, a young man came to me, a beautiful young man, 6 years sober. He was really distraught, in despair. And I listened to him. I listened to him for the better part of 2 hours as he shared with me all that was wrong. And it was a lot. And when he got done, he says, "Tom, what do I do?" And I said, "Please join the program." And he got furious. "What do you mean, join the program?" he said. "I've been in the program for 6 years. I said, "You need to go back to step one and begin all over again, this time as a way of life." He did. And things are going pretty well now. If recovery is chosen during this period, then the recovering person becomes aware of his self-hate, finally, and begins to deal with it. He often needs help in spotting it. It's a fleeting enemy. My friends and my family finally made me aware of the way that I hated myself. And I think sometimes we need outside help to see this. I was sitting around the breakfast table one morning with one of my dearest friends in the program, his wife, his oldest daughter, and my then wife, Donna. These people were always telling me how much they love me. And I'd respond, "Well, I'm glad you do, but I don't see why." They were always telling me what a good person I was, and I said, "Well, I'm glad you think so, but I don't see why you say that." The same old routine, not realizing what I was saying, really. And my friend looked at me with fire in his eyes, and he says, "I am damn sick and tired of your putting yourself down." And his wife chimed in, and his daughter chimed in, and Donna chimed in. And they were all sick and tired of it. And I got sick and tired of the whole thing. And I said, "If I'm so great, why don't you take a positive inventory of me?" And I slammed out the front door. I had them then, boy. They did. 1 week later, sheaf of paper, all four. They said, "Read this." I went in my den, I sat down and I read it. And I bawled for about 2 hours. They hadn't said a thing that wasn't true. And I could not see it until they pointed it out. And then I got doing some crazy stuff. I've always had a quiet time in the morning. The quality of it's improved over the years. And during this quiet time, what I call my not thinking time, I started giving myself some strokes. Now I got to tell you that all I could come up with in the beginning was, "Tom, you're neat and you're punctual." That's all I could come up with. But I'd repeat those things to myself until they settled in. I took a list and I put on the back of my bedroom door the kind of person that I wanted to be, the qualities that person would have. I numbered them. And I took number one. Maybe it was kindness. And I went out and practiced being kind for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks until I felt like I was doing pretty good. And I went back and checked it off and moved down to the next one, which may have been patience. I worked at it. And if you don't work at your self-hate, it will destroy you, recovering person or not. I also look for good in my life, and I acknowledge it. I began to do that. My kids say to me, "You're the best father in the whole world." I say, "Ain't it the damn truth?" And I watch for what Sid Simon calls vultures, these put-downs. "You know, you're okay." And I go on about my business. But unless I watch, the vulture comes and brings all of his friends, all of them. recovering person becomes aware of his sexuality and its power and begins to treat it with care and respect during the 5 to 7 year period. But self-hate diminishes, relationships expand and improve. Intimate relationships are now possible for most. The value system now includes other people. And incredible as it may seem, the person becomes able to receive love. Able to receive love. One of my teachers in the self-help program was a beautiful man from Texas. The epitome of a Texan. Big, strong, rich. Why are all Texans rich? He really was, you know. He's dead now, and I miss him. His name was Bob. And Bob always called me Sugar. He's the only man on the face of the earth that ever got away with calling me Sugar. And every time I saw Bob, he'd pick me up in his arms, give me a great big hug, God, I loved it, and kiss me on the cheek, say, how you doing, Sugar? God, I love the man. Fantastic man. And I was sitting with him, and I listened to him a lot. He never said anything that, he didn't waste words, you know what I mean? He said to me one day, he said, Thompson, you know what the greatest thing in the world is? And I said, no, Bob, what is it? He says, when somebody says to you, I love you, and you say, yeah, I know it. It's almost like Nature Boy, isn't it? Doesn't seem like much. The whole world hangs by a thread. The recovered person moves into the world of we. Moves further toward wholeness, toward union with the higher power and others. And recovery now begins to flow through the recovered person, on to others and back. If families and family helpers are aware of these periods of growth and the problems that may occur, they can better deal with these if and when they arise. Better still, and I believe this, the family can become an integral part of the recovery process if they choose, and nothing will help the recovering person more than for this to happen. See, families can recover too, y'all. Sobriety is for families as well as for chemically dependent people. Thank you.